This is Dumbline, the podcast of dumb crimes and even dumber criminals.
Get your Dumbline playing, heading for some true crime. Looking for some dumbness in a bunch of stupid ways. Yeah, Marie is gonna make it happen. Tell a tale in a groovy way. Fire all of her dumbs at once, and it's the hottest new craze. Hey, dummies.
Wow, Steppin' Greg.
That was impressive.
Hey, that was good.
Yeah. Welcome, dummies, to another episode of Dumbline. My name is Greg, your host. Here's my goffin buddy, Jason.
Hello, everybody.
And the glamorous Maria.
Hey, dummies.
I sat on a bus this week, and I had the absolute pleasure of having two people on the bus playing different YouTube videos on their speakerphones.
Oh, yeah. My God.
And I had no earbuds with me. It was such a joy.
Not having... like your earbuds or headphones. Like if I forget mine, I forgot mine going to work twice last week. It completely throws everything off. I feel like I can't even work.
It's horrible. Yeah. The environment around us is horrible. And these people on speakerphones, they're in waiting rooms. They're in grocery stores. They're just walking around on speakerphones having conversations.
I don't understand why they don't understand that other people use headphones.
But and you can get a pair of decent earbuds for pretty cheap.
Yeah. $12 probably.
Yeah. Decent.
I would guarantee Five Below has headphones.
Yeah, that are decent.
Yeah, no, better than just a speakerphone.
It's crazy. And they're okay. Were they looking at each other or were they like totally cool?
No, they're just doing their own thing, both watching their videos. The one guy was watching a video of like zoo lions. I don't even know what the fuck he could have been watching. I just heard them talking about
actual the lions
at the zoo. Yeah. And like, can we, they're smartphones. These designers can't just make a sensor that's like, oh, the speakers will not work because you're in a public setting. This is rude and obnoxious.
Yeah,
right?
That would be amazing.
Just you're in public. You're on a bus. No, get some headphones. We will not play this on speakerphone. Hold this to your ear.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a
good idea.
That is a good idea.
Anyway, that's the joys of public transportation in the city. Hey, Marie, you got a headline?
I do.
Extra, read all about it. Extra, read all about it.
This week's headline is from the Register Herald, Beaver, West Virginia.
Hey, Maria, starting off on the edge already.
May 6th, 2015, so it's vintage too. It's vintage Beaver. Man accidentally pepper sprays self, foiling robbery attempt.
Oh, that would be the worst. He's probably so bold and like tough guy.
Yeah,
stop right there.
That's like a bit,
right?
It's like a Will Ferrell bit. Like he points and it shoots back at him.
They end up taking everything out of his pockets while he's trying to.
It's kind of worse than that. Michael Kevin Meadows entered Bypass Pharmacy, which does not sound trustworthy to me at all.
Bypass Pharmacy
sounds great.
Yeah.
He was wearing a paintball mask, so he used the pepper spray to kind of disable the staff, but then walked right into the cloud of pepper spray and disabled the staff. He didn't even just point the canister the wrong way.
Wait, does a paintball mask does not... No, that won't stop it?
No, it's just got, like vents.
Oh, that's horrible. What a maroon.
And incapacitated himself.
Yeah, right?
Oh, God.
All right, I got a feeling Maria has a little story of excruciating dumbness and crime.
I hope so.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
I really hope so. I could use a dumb story about a dumb criminal.
Yeah, today I was like, I'm just dying for dumbness today.
Yeah.
So no pressure.
Woke up.
Okay, well, you'll get it. Trust. This is what happens when a dumb gets everyone drunk on his own stupidity. Ooh. Sources include Chapter 1 of Rogues, True Stories of Grifters, Killers, Rebels, and Crooks by Patrick Radden Keefe.
Wow, that's
the longest title ever.
Yeah. It's a good book. It's actually a reporter who interviewed El Chapo at one point. He's done a lot of criminal reporting for The New Yorker and I think for The New York Times.
El Chapo.
Do you think there were other, like, Stalker didn't make it? They had a limit to four. He had, like, six types he tried to get into this title.
We can't make this title any longer. It's just going to cover the
doesn't work without Stalkers. Yeah.
That book was published by Vintage Books in 2022. Another book, the title of which I'll include at the end, Wine Spectator, Forbes, CBS.
Wine Spectator. Yeah. Wow, a little bougie crime.
Yes. Mm. The Independent, Wine Searcher, The Real Review, and Court Documents.
Pinkies out.
Pinkies out. That is perfect for what we're about to get into.
Nice.
By the mid-1980s, German music manager Hardy Rodenstock.
And this takes place in the 80s?
Mm-hmm.
This is 80s bougie.
80s bougie.
Music manager?
He was a German music manager. We're in... There's a little bit in London. There's some in New York. He's from Germany. Okay. Mostly Europe.
What's his fantastic name?
Hardy Rodenstock.
Hardy Rodenstock.
Hardy, like H-A-R-D-Y.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I want it.
I thought you said Artie.
I like Hardy.
He's become a wine connoisseur.
So is he managing successful
bands? He managed... he says, it's some places say more than one act, but it's a genre called Schlager from the 70s.
Oh, wow. Schlager.
Yeah, music. So if you imagine like
Schlager.
70s yacht rock and mainstream pop had a baby and sang in German, it would be Schlager.
Sounds German glorious. Shoegaze.
I don't know.
Sounds glorious. I would love to.
It's glorious. I'll play like a little
Schlager,
bit more.
Goldschlager. Schlager.
Yeah, it's Schlager. It's S-C-H. L-A-G-R.
Goldschlager.
Had no idea what that was. But anyway, all I could find was that he was manager for one band that came out on Polydor with one album.
Is that a good label?
It's a legit label.
It was legitimate. Definitely back then they put out a lot of records.
Yeah.
So Hardy is hanging out with friends when he gets a phone call about a shocking discovery in a cellar in Paris. As a building is being torn down, a walled-off hidden wine cellar is revealed. It contains bottles from the most famed vineyards in the world. Lafitte, Chateau de Quim, Mouton, and Margaux.
No idea.
Never heard.
They're like the biggies from like in the 20th century. If you were into wine, those were the French.
Those were the French
vineyards. Yeah.
He just found this behind a wall in Paris.
He got a call about it being found behind a wall in Paris. Yes.
Yeah, you know why we don't know? We're not from New York. We didn't spend time in Manhattan. Like, Maria, this is her wheelhouse.
No, I didn't know any of these until I did the story.
Sure, they just rolled off your tongue.
Do you know how long I practiced those? I have pronunciations in the comments over here.
Your French is very good, Maria. Yeah.
Hardy immediately hops on a plane from Munich to Paris and pays 20,000 francs, about $2,227 for the bottles. The most interesting among the bottles are 24 engraved with the initials THJ.
Who is that?
Hardy is known for hosting lavish wine tastings and feasts that last for hours and days.
Days.
Awesome.
Like 3 days.
Wine.
People like leave the table, vomit, and come back.
That was like high society back then. Like it was like that was like a thing. Like
yeah.
You would eat until you puked, and then they'd be like, "Oh, we'll just go throw up, and then you can eat more,
drink more." Definitely, yeah. I think they ate just as a ruse for all the wine they were drinking. The invitations become more and more exclusive as the 1980s progress, and among what I'm sure is an irritating group of wine elitists, he has made a name for himself as a rare wine collector.
Could you imagine how, like, this group of people hanging out with them?
Oh, women were not allowed. Women were not like allowed at the tastings.
Insufferable and horrible would it just be?
A bunch of dudes.
Oh, just a bunch of douchebag wine dudes.
Cigar everywhere.
It changes later, just to be clear, but in the beginning it was like, yeah. His guests are critics, collectors, enthusiasts, and sometimes the owners of vineyards themselves. He also has a growing friendship with Michael Broadbent, who's a powerful wine critic and a Christie's auctioneer.
Ooh, okay.
When Hardy gets his hands on the mysterious bottles from France.
That is such a name. I'm sorry. Michael Broadbent?
Yeah.
That guy's not a welder. Right?
No, it feels like he was born, like, if you say my name's Michael Broadbent, and he goes, I'm a wine connoisseur and an auctioneer for Christie's, you're like, of course you are.
Yeah, right. And I went to Oxford. Like, he's definitely,
yeah,
sure. like,
yeah, yeah. He's not. I needed a guy to come over and fix my refrigerator. His name's not going to be Michael Broadbent. And it's just not happening. No. It was Curtis. Curtis Barnes came over and fixed my refrigerator.
When Hardy gets his hands on the mysterious bottles from France, the two decide to auction one off at Christie's. The bottle, a 1787 Lafitte, is auctioned in December 1985 and sells for approximately $157,000 to Christopher Forbes, son of Malcolm.
I guess that's still drinkable? Like, if you open that correctly and let it settle, you can still drink, like, a bottle of wine from the 1780s?
It's so rare that nobody really knows. And if a bottle is stored incorrectly or the cork is fucked up, it's totally bottle dependent. Yeah. It's not, there's no way to tell. I wonder
if they open that and take a sip.
It's the most ever spent on a bottle of wine and is even added to the Guinness Book of World Records.
Hmm. You know if it still holds the record?
It's not. Today, the most expensive bottle that's been sold is a 1945 Romanée Conti, which sold in 2018 for $558,000.
A Romanée what?
Conti, C-O-N-T-I. Oh. Yeah. The bottle sets such a record because it's believed to have been bought by Thomas Jefferson when he was minister to France in 1785.
So THJ.
THJ is Thomas Jefferson.
Hmm. I mean,
he already owned 24 engraved THJ bottles? Is that what we said earlier?
No, he found them.
He found them in Paris and bought a lot of bottles.
He bought them.
Yeah. Before the auction, Christie's glass expert affirms that the bottle and engraving are consistent with those of 18th century France. As you can imagine, the Jefferson wine is fervently scooped up by collectors when news of the sale spreads.
This guy probably made a shit ton on these Jefferson wine bottles.
In addition to the bottle's former owner being Thomas Jefferson, there was a wine blight in the late 1870s in Europe when an insect called Phylloxera destroyed the grapevines, attacked the Bordeaux region, and made any wines from vines that survived that blight highly desirable. So not only is it Thomas Jefferson, it's also a very rare vine. Jefferson was really knowledgeable and passionate about wine and wrote fairly extensively about it. And he's sometimes known as the first wine connoisseur in the United States.
Mm. Who knew?
I didn't know. Yeah. I had no idea. Yeah. Apparently, he was insufferable about it. John Adams once was like, and of course, we got the whole, spiel about wine from Jefferson.
John Adams, like, this dick won't stop talking about wine.
Just wants to have a beer. Yeah. He's going off about these fucking wines.
Yeah, he probably hated it.
At one point, Jefferson did ask that the bottles being shipped back to the U.S. for himself in Washington be labeled. And further, in his move from France, 125 bottles of his disappeared. In addition to selling the Jefferson bottles, Hardy brings extravagant wines to other events. As the guest of a member of the family who by the late 80s has owned Chateau de Kim for more than a century, he brings a bottle of the vineyard's own 1787 vintage. The owner and Hardy both describe the wine as excellent.
So this guy's just like the wine,
He's the wine god,
like Dionysus. Reborn.
Oh, nice pull there.
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, he's just pulling up these like 1700, 1800. Like, that's.
People are just bringing shit over to hang out with them.
And how much money is these bottles worth? Is he drinking millions of dollars?
Well, the price definitely went up after the $157,000 Christie's auction.
Yeah.
So they probably just keep going up from there. At Hardy's own events, a sommelier would quickly grab the corks from guests before they could examine them. Oh, so anytime a guest picked up a cork, a sommelier popped out of nowhere and was like, apparently said nine and took it. No. Hardy even brings bottles to parties and then asks for the empties back when he's leaving.
Oh, man.
You can't ask for the empties.
They're like NDAs, right? No, there's been no sight of these. I've never been here with this. Yes.
And here comes so much Dom. Before the famed Christie's auction, the New York Times publishes a story about experts at Monticello, Jefferson's Virginia home, doubting the validity of the Jefferson wine.
That's a couple days before.
It was in October and the auction was in December.
Oh, that's bad.
They do not believe that the Jefferson bottles were genuine.
You got a boat. Whatever's coming out of Monticello is like the...
I mean...
That's like the be-all, end-all of Thomas Jefferson. Like, you can't, like... You can't fight Monticello when it comes to Jefferson.
Who are they saying it to, though? I mean,
they're releasing a report.
Yeah, we have no internet back then. I mean,
well, it's in the New York Times.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Chris Forbes must not read the New York Times.
He couldn't get it.
No. Wasn't he was grounded yet. From it. He was grounded from it. He could only read Forbes. Jefferson kept meticulous records of his finances that included receipts. But the wine that was discovered was not among any of those receipts. There's no mention of it.
They have like stuff where they can date back with receipts.
Jefferson kept everything. He kept meticulous daily expenses.
That's I mean, dude, I guess.
He's getting weirder and weirder, yeah, this but, Jefferson guy.
But I guess you have nothing to do back then. Why wouldn't you take note? I mean, you got to fill time somehow.
Nothing to do. He's ready to write a Declaration of Independence or something. What do you write? I don't know what he wrote.
He like established democracy and is running a new country. I feel like he's a little busy. Like
no, start a university maybe.
I understand. I understand all that, but you still... you still have time to take you. It's 20 minutes, half hour.
That's true. All this much is he spending during the day?
Relax at night organizing receipts by candlelight?
Yeah, because you know what? There's nothing else to do.
True. His orders didn't include Lafitte, the brand auctioned at Christie's. Jefferson also left Paris in 1789, which is too soon for a 1787 vintage to even be bottled. None of his other wine bottles were engraved, nor is there any other documentation that points to Jefferson asking for bottles to be engraved.
Oh, boy.
So when they were sent over, he did not ask for them to be engraved?
He asked for them to be labeled, but they were boxes of wine, so it would make no sense for them to engrave on individual bottles if everything's in boxes. Okay.
That makes sense.
So to be fair, Christie's auction description did include the fact that there's no hard proof that Jefferson owned the wine.
That's a little asterisk.
That's awesome. Thomas Jefferson's personal wine, asterisk. This may not be Thomas Jefferson's wine.
3-point print.
Yeah. We cannot confirm Thomas Jefferson ever touched or owned or drank his wine.
Or even drank any wine.
Yeah. He was sober.
But he was a human being alive at the same time and in the same country where this wine was produced. Clearly it's his.
It was like Thomas Jefferson from Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah.
The Monticello
Thomas Harold Jefferson. That's not me.
Yeah, that's the wrong. You got the wrong guy.
The Monticello scholar goes on to note that engraving 1,200 bottles of wine would have been really expensive and would have definitely been on Jefferson's receipts. If he had asked.
That is true.
How happy is this? What is he, archivist or whatever?
Jefferson scholar. She's a Jefferson scholar.
Yeah, he's just the bust hardy Rodenstock's fucking bubble.
Probably loving this. Loving it.
Like nothing about this makes sense at all.
You didn't know? You didn't know that Thomas Jefferson kept meticulous receipts of everything that came and entered his house?
This is the whole story is the origin of he's got receipts.
Yeah. And he's,
You know, I brought receipts.
And he's got to be like, fuck, Thomas Jefferson, I'm just trying to scam a couple bottles of wine, and now I got this lady talking about receipts, and what the fuck?
He's just like, nine.
Yeah. He's not even a sommelier, I bet.
Lastly, when Jefferson did ask his wine to be labeled, it was with the initials T.I. He also used the initials T.J., and T.H. J, but not T.H. J.
These guys, if you're gonna do this like this forgery, you gotta do some research and figure out how he signed this stuff.
I feel like you could go to Monticello and probably ask a whole bunch of questions about his wine collection.
Yeah, and then go back and just recreate it.
Yeah.
That's.
So the experts also question how the same engraver would have been used for four different vintners. Good question.
And who thinks
he's the best? He's the best.
Also, who thinks this like scheme up? Are they just like hanging out on the couch and they're just like, you know what I'm going to do?
This is what happens when guys sit around with no women.
Yeah, Thomas. You know, what'd be awesome. We'll have these bottles, old bottles of wine, and we'll say that Thomas Jefferson owned them. Yeah. And then we'll sell them.
Brilliant.
Like it's so bizarre. Like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
It really is. Especially
when 12 dudes are sitting around doing nothing. This is what fucking happens.
Some common sense. Some ladies around.
It is also, it's not like, if they had done this in like the late 1800s, I'd be like, okay, there are, you know, less hard scientific processes, but this is the 1980s.
Yeah, it's...
Things have moved along a little bit.
His parties must have taken a nosedive after this.
Oh, yeah. Or maybe they were extra exclusive now.
Yeah.
Because they're in an 8x12 cell.
So Michael and Hardy are furious about the report.
Yeah.
Hardy writes to Monticello's director, quote, "One should courteously keep back one's dubious and unfounded remarks, and one shouldn't make oneself important in front of the press."
He was talking like this in 1985? Did he like slap him with a glove afterwards and challenge him to a duel? Like, you know why he's talking like that in New York in 1985?
Well, he's in Europe.
Maria was so good with that reenactment.
That's right.
I feel like I was at a museum where you press a button and you hear someone talk where you have like the earphones when you walk around. Maria was so good with that.
Yes.
The vintners side with Hardy, confirming that they believe the bottles aren't forged.
They aren't?
The vintners believe, the vineyards believe the bottles are legitimate and side with Hardy against Monticello.
Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, they probably want the notoriety that they have, you know, Thomas Jefferson bought bottles of wine there.
Or they're just in a giant wine circle jerk and can't believe any of them would be wrong because they just tell each other how great they are all the time. I mean, it's like an insular thing. It's not a huge community.
The scholar was a woman?
Yeah.
They're
so irritated that it was.
Goddamn nerd. Everything up for us.
Yeah. This nerd woman's killing us.
Nerd woman.
Get a life.
Yeah. They're furious.
Oh, yeah.
Can't imagine.
In 1986, another of the bottles is up for auction. This one's a white.
I love, does she just like pop up? Is she at the auction? She's like, yo, that's fake.
Yeah,
I wouldn't buy that.
The buyer is Dodi Al-Fayed. And just for anybody who doesn't know, that's the other victim of the crash that killed Princess Diana in 1997.
Yeah, it's Princess Di's boyfriend at the time, right?
Mm-hmm. He pays the equivalent of $56,628 in pounds. And at the time, it's the most ever paid for a white wine.
So everyone's just ignoring this woman.
Yeah.
Everybody's just pushing forward.
Oh, my God.
They're like, she doesn't know what she's talking about. We know.
Yeah.
I'm Dodi Al-Fayed. Yeah. I know wine more than this.
This new listing is like, Thomas Jefferson may have never drank wine. And there's a person who says this is totally fraudulent. We don't know who's telling the truth. Buyer beware.
Yeah, it's like a QR code that links to like this huge... her dissertation telling about how fake it is. And they're just like, I don't care.
They're do I see 50? Anybody for 50?
She's out front with like a sandwich board sign on all this proof document, the receipts.
She's like handing it out. Like, would love her to just be interrupting the action.
Yeah.
In 1987, another bottle is auctioned to Marvin Shanken, the editor and publisher of Wine Spectator.
God.
How much did that one go for?
I don't have the total on that one.
Okay. It's got to be more than 50-something thousand bucks.
Well, now, right? It's another Jefferson bottle. So a white went for 56,000. The first red went for 157,000. So this was probably another red. I don't think there were that many whites mixed in there. So I would think that one is at least 150, maybe 200,000.
So he's making significant money on these that he bought for 2,000 bucks.
Right.
It's pretty good return.
Yeah.
It's not bad.
For a bit. Meanwhile, Hardy begins inviting more and more discerning palates to his tastings, which is good for his reputation, sort of.
You know, this is like, you know, these bottles are filled with like the barefoot. They're like, there's some shitty wine. It's
Carlo Rossi. He's got Carlo Rossi gallon jugs.
Those old gallon jugs with the little finger hook on it.
The sommeliers in the back, like pouring them all into bottles.
100%.
As his guests are increasingly discerning and knowledgeable, some of them comment that all the wine tastes the same. They can't figure out why all the wines they're tasting taste exactly the same.
So Bartles and James.
He also serves wine in magnums that for certain vintages don't make sense because the vineyards weren't even popular or profitable at the time. So they wouldn't be making magnums. They would just be making regular size bottles. So people start to wonder.
So he's pulling out magnums of wine with
from vineyards that didn't make magnums.
So he's like, holy shit! So he's got to be like forging these wine labels and making these bottles and everything. That's,
I mean, he can't be doing this alone. It's got to be an operation.
Well, him and dude.
No, Michael Broadbent is just supporting the fact that they're legitimate bottles. He's actually not involved in any of the back end of this stuff. He's making a lot of money. He's the Christie's auctioneer who keeps unloading the bottles. So he's invested in it.
He doesn't know anything?
Not as far as anything I read. He doesn't know anything. Bill Koch of the infamous Koch Industries family buys four Jefferson bottles and three other 18th century bottles by 1988.
How much money did he spend? That's got to be close to $1 million.
He spent $500,000 in 1988. So imagine how much that would be now. And though they're all bought through distributors, all the bottles he buys can be traced back to Hardy.
You know, fuck all these guys. Fuck all these people that buy these bottles of wine for this much. They deserve to get fucking ripped off. Who needs a $50,000 bottle of wine?
Hardy continues making stunning finds, including a rare 1929 vintage.
This is the guy that found all those forged documents. They just keep finding these bottles.
100 cases of Bordeaux in Venezuela.
Oh my God.
And 19th century wine from Russia, from a czar apparently in Russia.
Holy shit. This guy's got a nose for wine.
Another buyer, Hans-Peter Frerichs, grows suspicious of Hardy in the early 1990s and has the wine carbon dated.
Hans, a guy. A
Hans guy. Peter
Frerichs. They're going to be like, oh, Hans is saying it? Oh, well, maybe we should listen to this.
So based on the chemical composition of the wine, the lab can only date it to 1962 or later.
Wow, man, oh, man.
That's not the 1700s.
That is definitely not the 1700s.
1962 or later. That is 1982.
Yeah. Pressure to reveal the seller mounts when the results are released. But of course, Hardy says people are just jealous of his success.
Probably
that
are.
That carbon dating is wrong, and it's jealous.
Right, it's jealous. Yes. The scientist and the whole lab in Germany are jealous.
Are jealous.
He also makes multiple excuses for why he can't name his source. Sometimes he blames taxes. I don't know why. At other times, he says he swore he wouldn't name the seller.
Taxes.
Does he just say taxes?
Can you,
the shrug emoji?
Yeah. Can you give me your source? Taxes.
He also says he wants to publish his own story someday, so he's not telling anybody.
That's a good excuse. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving up my story because I'm going to write a book eventually.
More evidence of forgery begins being noticed. A cork at one tasting is noted as the same from another vintner presented at a tasting the week before.
Oh, he missed it. Who missed it?
Who's fucking recognizes the same cork?
These are the nerdos that go to his dinners. They all know all this shit.
The nerdos.
By this time, though, women are going too. So maybe women were like, oh, I see a detail here.
I guarantee you the woman blew this whole thing up.
It all falls apart when the women get involved.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I mean, their attention to detail is better.
Attention to detail is different.
And they're going
to
be like, this is bullshit. they'll call out bullshit.
Another cork is too short to be from the vineyard it's allegedly from. Dates are sawed off of other corks.
Jesus, this is
sawed off.
This is so
sanded
elaborate.
Off. I should have said sanded off.
This
sorry.
Is so elaborate. This ruse of
it's elaborate,
wine.
Elaborately wrong.
Yeah,
it's like all of these places where things could fall apart and everything's just a tiny bit off.
Yeah, it's just like this cork says 1987 on it.
Yeah,
like you gotta pay attention to detail. At least the document guy, he had some good details.
That's true.
Yeah, that guy was on point.
Yeah.
The shapes and sizes of the bottles don't match.
This is a Gatorade bottle.
This says vintage blue.
Yeah,
what does that mean?
It's just like random bottles he just starts putting it in.
Why is Michael Jordan on my bottle?
It's like a Fanta, an orange Fanta bottle. Like one's a Yuritos bottle.
Yeah.
Like it's just these random glasses.
This is from the Shasta Vineyard. Wine experts begin stating outright that bottles bought from Hardy are frauds.
Mm. Is this lady, is the woman that originally called it, she's got to be like, I fucking told you.
She must be insufferable at Monticello. Yeah, they're like, you're going to take all the elementary school kids on tours because we can't talk to you anymore right now.
I told them. She probably wouldn't, yeah. She's right, though.
I mean.
She did tell them.
Around the same time, Hans Peter decides to sell his whole wine collection and asks Sotheby's to send an expert to price it. Mm. The Sotheby's representative notices labels that are the wrong colors and shapes.
You know what? I'm going to just unload this whole thing. How much?
This guy's the worst fraudster.
Most of the older bottles are in astoundingly good condition, which the representative becomes suspicious of. He identifies 80 bottles as coming from Hardy, and he believes they're all forgeries.
Mm. Holy.
So Hans Peter files a complaint against Hardy in German court, and prosecutors in Germany decide that Hardy has tampered with the wine, or at least knows that the wine has been doctored. Hardy appeals, and the matter is settled out of court. Bill Koch, the crazy pants who bought four Jefferson bottles, becomes consumed with holding Hardy accountable in the 2000s.
Oh, this guy, he's...
The 2000s?
Yeah.
He's nuts. He's those Koch brother guys. Yeah. He probably wants to hang this guy out in back of his house.
A team of investigators begins putting the pieces together. They also have the wine tested, but the results are inconclusive.
They start putting the pieces together that none of the bottles look like they're supposed to.
This is like 20 years later.
I know. Now they're putting the pieces together. Jesus Christ. It's crazy.
Well, Bill Koch was like an outlier. He wasn't like in this little cabal of wine collectors who hung out together. He's like a rich person who wants to invest in wine. So he doesn't have the same deferential.
But even like the cop, like nobody has investigated this whole thing. Like,
I mean, he still bought well after the woman came out. The art.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did.
Monticello person, right?
Yeah.
I mean.
And here comes more dumb. They bring a bottle to a glass and tool expert who notes that the slant of the engraving isn't possible using an 18th century tool.
It's a Dremel.
Ding, ding, the ding, old, ding.
Is it?
Oh, man.
They find a receipt for a Dremel from Home Depot on his table.
He tells investigators that it's definitely made by an electric tool. When one of the investigators tries to use a Dremel to recreate the engraving, it works. He does it at home.
Wow.
He just tests it out on a bottle at home, and he does it within an hour or something. Bill sues Hardy in 2006, and complete lunacy ensues on Hardy's part. He refuses to participate in court proceedings at all. His lawyer withdraws from the case in 2007. Hardy states that unless the court proceedings are held entirely in German, he will not defend himself.
Oh, man. This guy.
The only thing with that is that even if he did not speak English very well, he's been faxing people. Like, whenever somebody criticized him in public, he would fax people a million letters written in English. So they know he's proficient in English. It doesn't even work that, like, hey, you don't have an interpreter today. I can't, you know.
Yeah, he's just like, I need it in German.
Right. But there is paper everywhere with his name on it written in English because he faxed people instead of calling them. In 2010, a default judgment is filed against him. Bill is owed $311,486.90 in damages.
He's probably not going to get that.
I doubt he's seen that money. Hardy Rodenstock retreats to Germany and dies May 19th, 2018, at the age of 76. As of 2013, Bill Koch had spent $25 million on lawsuits related to wine fraud.
He went after everybody.
I mean, if you have that money and you're like, I mean, these guys are billionaires, you might as well just be like, all right.
Yeah.
You're going to fuck with me. I'm just going
to. Hardy ever go to jail?
No.
Oh, wow.
Right. He just default judgment. I'm not paying. Bounced and he's gone.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's it.
Yeah.
So, and then, so he got all his money. He never had to pay.
Never really was held responsible at all. Man. And then just before.
So he won.
Yeah.
He kind of, I mean, except kinda for the fact wins. That not everybody thinks he's a god anymore, which I think was kind of the point.
Yeah.
I don't think
any of dancing around in a robe, listening to the Schlager music.
Yeah, like, he's good to, he's good
it's
to
like
go.
It's like the last scene in Saltburn.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That's where they got it from.
Yeah, drinking like a Martini and Rossi jug.
Yeah, he's got these, like, I like this wine. He's drinking his favorite wine that he used to fill all those bottles up with.
Before I forget, the name of the second name of the book that I didn't name at the beginning was The Billionaire's Vinegar, The Mystery of the World's Most Expensive Bottle of Wine by Benjamin Wallace, published by Crown Publishing in 2009. It's a really good book. If you like crime...
So you don't really know what wine that he was filling up the bottles with? Like, you
it's a blend of all kinds of things. Like, there were certain
whatever's
tastings.
Laying around, dude.
Yeah, there are certain tastes. I think he would take wine from, like, an early 1900s bottle, put that in, mix it up with a little bit of whatever. I mean, he just...
It's amazing.
There were a lot of tastings where some of the guests were like, this tastes extraordinarily young. It only tastes about 30 years old. So it probably was only 30 years old.
It's such a, for me, it's such a world that I don't even buy a lot of the nonsense. I think there are people who can't tell the difference between a great vintage or a decent bottle. I don't know. We recapping Dumb or?
I mean, I don't know. If
don't
we,
pick
I don't
Thomas know. Jefferson. It's kind of like. The other guy with the signatures from, you know, Daniel Boone and Abraham Lincoln.
I just want to know, like, how he sided on Thomas Jefferson. I guess maybe because he knew he was, like, a wine.
Right. Might have been the oldest wine connoisseur.
And there's also, like, documentation that he lost 125 bottles. Okay. So there's a loophole there of, like, well, there is, you know, he did lose this case. So there's not, Monticello didn't come back and say he never lost any wine.
Gotcha.
But at least, like, know which kind of wine he drank.
Yeah.
Know, like, what vineyards, like, you know, the bottles or the labels look like.
Don't make magnums.
What initials he used.
Yeah. Don't make magnums.
Yeah.
Out of, like, from that they didn't give magnums.
Switch up the corks. Yeah. You know, it's all these little details. Yeah.
And that's what, like, though, I would assume, like, these wine connoisseurs, like, are, like, everything's about the details. It's got to be all about the details. If they know the wine cork is like a quarter of an inch too long.
Was the person from the vineyard. That was one of the ones that was a big mistake where, like, someone handed this over to someone who ran a vineyard and said, this isn't the cork we use.
Yeah,
that's like, you have those people at the table and you're serving that vintage. Well, and
this is not, that's why dude kept nine.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That was good, Maria.
It was good. Man, these fraudsters.
There's a lot of them out there.
Yeah, ballsy.
Yeah. And you can't even trust these auction places.
Christie's
was like, that glass looks good. Okay.
Everybody's just looking for the buck.
Yep. All chasing the buck. All right, Jason, tell people where our socials are.
You guys can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook. We are Dumbline Podcast. Come on over, check out all of our great and amazing content. Say hello. And also, as always, please like, subscribe, share. It only takes a couple seconds. So thanks for taking care of that for us. And pass it back to Greg.
All right. It's everybody's favorite time of the day. Get to know Maria.
Get to know Maria.
Get to know her.
Maria, what is your favorite carnival or boardwalk game?
I like whack-a-mole best.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, gee, whack-a-mole. Man.
It's good, aggressive. You just pound, bam, bam.
Yeah,
I like that the best.
All right, nice. All right, my name is Greg.
I'm Jason.
I'm Maria.
Take it easy.
See ya.
Bye, dummies.